Welcome to the Mumbrella Cast. I'm Tim Burrows. Joining me in the studios is CBS Interactive, Fleischman Hillard's VP of Digital Media, Scott Rohde.
Hi, Tim.
Ken Lyons, Executive Chairman, Terry Savage.
Morning.
And Jonathan Est from the Media Alliance.
Good day, Tim.
This week, the Oprah phenomenon. Fairfax pulls the plug on sport and style. Where's the fun gone from advertising? And Aussie editors stand behind WikiLeaks. Now, Terry, we'll start with you this morning. Chairman of the Ken Lyon International Advertising Festival, or as it's recently become, the Festival of Creativity. What's the thinking behind the change, first of all?
Well, of course, when the festival was first started, it was the Advertising Film Festival. We then migrated that because we introduced press, outdoor, radio, direct, and so on. The reality today is with platform thinking, we're no longer just about advertising. PR has an advertising component, but it has so much more. Design has an advertising component and has so much more. And areas such as gaming, social networking, branded content, all of which are making up part of the platform thinking, aren't in the strictest sense of the word advertising. So we're really reflecting what is happening in the business.
And I suppose the word creativity kind of opens up a lot of new areas as well. Do you think it will always be, in some way, though, about recognising ideas where people are paid to help brands reach consumers? Is that the overall definition?
I think always is a long time, but I certainly think in the foreseeable future, clearly we are about the communication process. So I think, in fact, one of the things we wrestled with is it should have been the Festival of Creative Communications, but we felt creative communications a bit boring. But certainly in the short term to mid-term, we have no thought to take it wider, albeit one of the things we're introducing at Cannes this year is a thing called Cannes Also, which will give creatives who create for a living, but also create for a hobby, an opportunity to display art or sculpture or film that they create in their sort of downtime on an ongoing basis. So there's clearly a crossover, but in reality, from our perspective, it is about communication.
And that'll be an exhibition, won't it?
That will be an exhibition, yeah. That's just a bit of fun, yeah. A bit of inspiration. I mean, Cannes is above all about inspiration, so it will give people an opportunity to see another side of the creative process.
Well, this is one of the things I was going to ask about, because I suspect that people who haven't been to Cannes would think of it first and foremost as an awards competition.
Sure.
But obviously, there's more to the festival than that. Sort of philosophically, what do you see it as being about first and foremost? Is it all of the other things that go on outside of the ceremonies, or are the ceremonies the most important part?
Well, I think the mandate that the work is the most important is maintained, but in this environment, in 2011 as it will be, the reality is that it's very hard to justify going to the south of France or to Asia for Spikes Asia or Dubai for Dubai Lynx unless it's a takeout that they are bringing back to their home offices, that they're spreading within their own universes. So Cannes, more than ever, is now about learning. The pace of change of what's happening in the business is enormous. So we're very, very focused on the learning experience as well as the inspiration, as well as the networking opportunities. But we really want people to go there, be inspired by the work, but be inspired by the speakers and the learning experience they're getting from what is increasingly becoming an awesome program of the world's thought leaders.
And I'm not sure that everyone realises that Cannes is run by an Australian living in Australia as well. do you find a lot of your life on a plane?
Well, I do, but I mean, we're very lucky. In fact, Cannes is run by me in Australia, but our CEO, Phil Thomas, of course, is based in London. And Phil does an awful lot of the work in terms of running the office and so on and so forth.
Makes your ideas happen.
We work very much as a team together. And I'm, in a sense, the guy that can come back here and sort of lie in the sunshine every so often, where Phil's always in the heart of it. But, it's a great thing for me. I mean, clearly I have to travel a lot. But the reality of our jobs anyway is that Phil has to travel a lot. and one person can't cover the world to the level that we need to cover the world. So I tend to focus on very specifically Asia,
Middle East, equator, and he's above and you're below.
Well, not quite, but not quite that. But we both know the areas that we can concentrate on and do it effectively. Which, as I say, you need two people to actually do that.
And actually, you mentioned Asia, and spikes has sort of suddenly become more relevant for Australia over. I think was this year the first year that Australian agencies were eligible?
Yeah, it was the first year they were eligible, and they did very well, as one would expect them to do. And I think spikes, in fact, in the next 10 years, if there's going to be an event that rivals Cannes in terms of number of people attending, it will be spikes. Because, you know, you've got huge growth happening, you've got tremendous interest from the rest of the world in the region, and that could be seen by the power of the speakers we had at spikes last year. You know, we had, I think, five global leaders. They want to have a voice in the region.
Sorrell was there, wasn't he?
Sir Martin Sorrell was there. David Jones was there. Bob Jeffries was there. Howard Draft was there. Andrew Robertson was there. Well, there's I'll probably offend Tom Bernardin was there. So, I mean, that is a heavyweight crowd to have at a regional festival.
And you touched on this idea of having to justify to your management the idea of travelling to the south of France for a week. One of the other things that you've launched this year is an award for effectiveness for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
What's the thinking behind that? Is that part of that process to give some respectability to these otherwise kind of slightly hard to measure creative?
I think the reality from our perspective is we're a reflection of the industry. We can't lead the industry. We can't be ahead of the industry. We have to be just behind it and get a feeling for what the industry wants. The reality is ROI and effectiveness is a really, really important and increasingly important component of the relationship between agencies and the client.
Shouldn't that always have been the case?
I think that always has been the case. But whereas 10 years ago, we could never have played in that field because we've in fact introduced direct and promo media, which have results components to them, it's a lot sort of more palatable.
Yeah, I suppose that's probably because I come from the PR. I come from PR, so it's always been
exactly. So PR results is results oriented as well. So we now got categories that have results within them, and I think people are far more accepting. The other thing that I think has enabled this to be sort of brought forward more easily is 7 years ago when I first started at Cannes. We had no clients at Cannes. They simply were invisible. Last year, 15% of our delegate base was clients. And I think the agencies have, in fact, embraced that concept. The clients want to learn more about creativity. So the timing seemed right. And I think the other key point that should be remembered about our effectiveness award is it's a bit different to most other people's.
You still have to have won a creative award, first of all, don't you?
Exactly. You have to have been a winner or shortlisted at Cannes the previous year to be invited to enter effectiveness at Cannes the following year.
So is that to sort of protect yourself against just having something dreadfully dull but effective winning?
No, I think it was more about keeping to our central theme, and that is that we're about creativity. So what we're doing is actually creating a direct link between creative work that has been awarded at Cannes, and was it effective? So, in fact, whichever way you look at it, if there's a pile of winners that say, yes, this was very, very effective, then it's good. If there aren't a pile of winners that said it wasn't very effective, well, that's also good, because the industry really needs to know that.
Well, another thing I'd be quite interested to sort of find out a bit more about is, you know, I've been along to Cannes, so I've sort of, you know, arrived at the jury press conference on the day that the awards are given out in any individual category. What's the process that takes us to this point? Because I'm sure there's actually quite a big logistical process that goes from the moment of call for entries through to the moment of handing over the trophies.
Sure. Well, clearly, I mean, the first thing we've got to do is appoint 200 plus jurors from all over the world, which we right now in the process of 2011 appoint the jury presidents. The work is entered, some of it digitally, other is still physical. So in London office, you still see thousands of packages sitting in brown paper boxes. That is then all processed prior to us going to Cannes. And the way we go to Cannes, frankly, is in the back of a truck. So we basically lift our whole office, put it on two trucks, in fact, and drive it down to the south of France and unpack our office.
And do you drive the lorry yourself?
I haven't driven the lorry, actually, because they want to get the truck to France. And there is a risk that wouldn't happen if I drove the lorry, especially on the wrong side of the road. And then we, once we're in Cannes, of course, we get the work ready for preparation and screening. And then the jury start, and the jury process can be incredibly rigorous. I mean, there are some people that are spending 8 days in a jury room.
And how do they do it? Do they sort of start with just everything and they go through and cull it down? Or?
Yeah, yeah. What will happen is, for example, let's take film. I mean, in film, in its heyday, it got 7,000 entries. Today it's about 5,000 entries. And there's a jury of, I think, 24, and that will be broken into four sub-juries who will each look at approximately 1,250 pieces of work. They will vote on that 1,250 pieces of work. And of course, some of that's long-form film these days, so some of it can be a 20-minute film or a 10-minute film. So it can take a long, long time to get through the long-form film. From that process, they vote, and a shortlist from an amalgamation of the four groups is created. And once that shortlist is created, then the jury will review the shortlist, understanding that three quarters of them haven't seen what is on that reel. So they will review it to make sure they're all comfortable with it. They will then re-vote it to create a short shortlist, and then from that short shortlist, there will be a discussion position. Now, the discussion is about the awarding of metal, and that awarding takes place the day before you see the press conference. So it might be 12 o'clock at midnight that jury process is finished, and the next day we have the press conference and the award ceremony.
What's the latest the jury has ever gone?
2 in the morning was the latest.
Was that because they couldn't agree on something?
Well, it was mainly about a Grand Prix, as a matter of fact. They'd finished sort of about 10 o'clock. But, you know, the fact of the matter is, they've been there for 8 days. They're tired. They're exhausted. And, you know, you're there very late on the final night.
And is it, do you have to have a unanimous jury, for instance?
You have to have more than unanimous. It's got to be two-thirds majority. So it's not 51%. It's got to be two-thirds. That is not easy. These are truly international juries. And to get two-thirds, it's got to be sort of an extremely sort of good piece of work.
And is it still hands up round the table, or are there electronic devices involved?
There are sophisticated electronic systems. So we've actually got lifetime judging. So we can actually see when everyone's voted what the scores are. We can see if there's any scoring irregularities. There's a whole lot of processes we have to do that. But when it comes to awarding the medal, the jury still prefer hands up. Yes. You know, they've got the ability to, in fact, just do it electronically, so you can just see a number on the screen, 12 for and 9 against, but they still prefer to do it hands up.
Is there ever a time you can see when you might actually release the entire judging process? You know, the details of who voted for what, for instance?
I think probably not. I mean, if an individual jury member wants to tell you himself, he can do so. We encourage them not to. But I don't think we'd ever get to the point where we sort of release that information, because I don't think it serves a purpose.
I don't think any awards do they?
No, I can't think of any. It would be a challenging amount of transparency.
Well, there is one award, and I forgot what it is, but they actually have their voting done in public on a couple of days, so you can actually go in and watch the jury.
Okay. It's like the X Factor.
In action, a bit like the X Factor.
A little glass cubicle or something. Now, Jonty, I'll bring you in at this point, because obviously one of the things that the Media Alliance is involved in organising is the Walkley Awards.
Yes.
How does that process compare to the Walkleys?
Well, the Walkley Award judging is based on a Pulitzer Prize. Essentially, we put together panels of judges across the whole journalism industry, and hopefully, you know, the judging sort of corresponds to the individual award. We have to be very careful that you cover all the bases, you cover all the news companies, all the platforms, all the different disciplines. I've been a judge. It's a very rigorous process. It's a lot of work, actually. I judged an award probably about 10 years ago, Social Equity, and it took me, I think at one point, I had sort of 30 hours of radio in one community radio as one entry. And you have to do my ironing to it. And It's a big
one. Well,
so
did you have some sort of job on the side?
Right. It's a big commitment that people make when they agree to be judges, and of course, you know, again, the idea of transparency and announcing who has voted for what would I think lead to. I'd hate to think what that would lead to in our
bravery.
Business, and then what we have, there is a Walkley Advisory Board, which is sort of made up of very senior journalists, again from across the industry, and they take the initial judging process produces three. Nominees in each category, and that then goes to the and they're announced publicly in the run up to the awards night, and then the Walkley Advisory Board sits down and it takes them a few days, and they go through everything and nominate a winner in each category kind of thing, and then from that you choose a gold Walkley winner, which was this year was Laurie Oakes, as we know, that's I think what makes that attractive to journalists is that they are aware that their work has been judged by their peers. You know, and it's you know, it's not members of the alliance. It's journalists from across the, you know, senior journalists from across the whole gamut of the industry.
It's funny actually, because I've sort of organised awards for Media Week in the UK, which sort of focuses on media agencies and in the Middle East, sort of for ad agencies and media agencies and PR agencies, and also over here when I was on BNT. And you'd find that different sort of sectors of the industry would have different views about this being judged by their peers thing. So, for instance, guys in advertising were generally comfortable enough with it, but I actually found that media agencies were quite resistant. You know, the idea of presenting to someone, and part of it was because it was presentations as well, the idea of presenting to one or sharing any of the kind of, you know, secret formula with people who could be a rival was, you know, there was a genuine resistance there.
I think for journalists and the way the process works is I think they like that the judges and we let them know, we let people know who the judges were in their category, you know, that's published. They like that people are given awards not just on what you read or what you see, but the process that has gone into actually getting that to print or getting that to broadcast or whatever. And I think journalists like that they're judged by people that understand difficulties, the hurdles that the people have had to jump over to get those stories, and I think probably the feeling is that, you know, that journalists would feel, you know what journalists are like, journalists would feel that only other journalists would be qualified to make those decisions.
That's right, because I judge awards here as well. I do the IT Journal Awards, but
yeah.
I'm PR, but I think because I'm an ex-journal, that's why I think it's kind of okay that they don't mind being judged by me. I think if I was just a solid PR person, then they would be like feel a bit strange about it.
No, that's right. The only journalists will understand
what the process if it's true, getting the story.
Yeah.
And Terry, with the Lions, it's entirely practitioners of advertising. You wouldn't, for instance, ever see the time where there might be a marketer on the jury.
No, I think effectively there will be marketers on the jury, and we have played with the media awards. We have marketers on the jury at one stage. But I think the reality that we feel is that we want the work to be judged by people who are themselves award winners, that have shown creative credentials of the highest order. And right now, that isn't clients, it is the creative community.
What do you, changing the subject slightly, what do you make of the idea of, I believe it's called Circus, the week-long festival that's being set up by the Communications Council here in Australia, so the awards, which used to be November, will kind of shift into next year, and there'll be various other events around it. Have you been following the announcements on that? Do you think it's a good model?
Look, you know what, I make a habit, for very good reasons, of never commenting on other people's events. And I wish them luck, and I hope it goes well for them. But I'm not going to get into the specifics of whether I think it's good, bad, or indifferent.
Which is a shame, because I was also going to ask you about this week, DNAD and the One Show announced they were launching the pencil ranking. Mm-hmm. So does that also come within the category of other organisations that you better not comment on?
Yes, I think that is right. But I will talk to you offline afterwards. I'll give a fascinating little insight
I will take you up on that. What do you see as... obviously, you'll have seen an awful lot of Australian work over the years. When it comes to Australia's strengths in the Lions, you know, crudely, I always think beer TV ads is, you know, Australia is perhaps best at. I suspect you could probably give a slightly more nuanced view.
I think we're far more sophisticated than people understand. I mean, last year at Cannes, Australia, I think, won 43 lions, was placed seventh in the world in terms of number of lions won. If you actually look at the history of Australia, we're always towards the top end, irrespective of the fact of the size of our country. Go one step further, and last year in promo and DM, there were 20 gold lions awarded, and Australia and New Zealand won 10 of them. I think where Australia has proven to be very, very strong is in this platform thinking concept. That I think they're a long way ahead of a lot of other countries that have got far bigger budgets, a lot more sophistication. And so I think what we do in Australia, and of course I'm totally neutral, and I say this as an observer, not an Australian, is something we should be very proud of, because we are very, very good at what we do, and that's why you'll find there are so many Australians from the ad business working overseas, because they have got this skill to think and do more and have a wider spectrum of skills than a lot of other people in other countries.
Now, both relatively new categories, PR lions and media lions. Mm-hmm. My sense is that Australian media and PR agencies, the ad agencies may be entering these categories, but
yeah,
the media and PR agencies either aren't putting themselves forward yet,
sure,
or they're not writing winning entries. Is it your sense that maybe they haven't quite got their head around the opportunity, the fact that it's there yet?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, PR, I think we're in our second year, and I think, in fact, there was a wonderful quote by Mark Pritchard, the head of Procter & Gamble, who basically came out and said, well, you know, PR agencies better understand they're in marketing as well as being in PR.
Yeah.
He said that quite recently, and I think that's about, you know, the change of our strapline more than anything else. But I think there are a couple of issues. One is that if you look at the media lines, for example, consistently agencies win media lines and
ad agencies.
Ad agencies win media lines because we look at things from the perspective of creativity.
Mm.
The ironic thing is that notwithstanding that ad agencies win them, ad agencies are never on the media jury. It's always totally 100% media people on that media jury. So they're giving the awards. And I think the same with PR.
Yeah.
I think there's a learning experience there. And I think one of the big issues is that as people sit on the jury, as people engage, they buy in.
Mm.
But it's probably a 5-year...
I'd come into this and say that I think PR comes in at a disadvantage, highly disadvantaged, because we, A, have much smaller budgets, therefore, you know, we don't have that ability, nor do we have the means, and a lot of the PR agencies don't have the means to develop showreels, to create these amazing presentations. You know, the majority of PR awards are usually literally, here's a booklet, here's the work we did, this was what the client wanted, this was the ROI, and that was what we've done. You know, and I think, I mean, obviously I work for a global agency, and I've discovered that through digital, we're now competing, working in the digital arena, we're competing against ad agencies, we're competing against social media companies, and we are, you know, we're a digital agency ourselves, so there's this convergence happening, but again, ad agencies rule the roost a lot of the time.
But do you think also though that maybe PR agencies, there isn't the same award entering culture? You know, for instance.
Oh, absolutely. You know, it's not ego driven.
Yeah, but but when you guys, for instance, are doing a campaign, does the internal conversation automatically happen? Hey, this would be a really good awards entry.
No, I've never seen that at all. We're focused on getting the communication message of the client out there and trying to ensure they get the best coverage for them.
But I think that the point that I think is interesting there, because there are some things in your business that will, you know, if you've got a crisis management issue, no one's ever going to broadcast it.
Absolutely not.
They won't give it under the table. But the fact is, if you are competing against ad agencies and social network organisations, you have to ultimately adopt this culture, because that's their measure of excellence.
Yeah, but the problem is, obviously, where we find sometimes difficult is we're up against ad agencies who... we're competing against them. They go in with a giant idea, ask them for the big budget to do the TVC and all the digital work, and then, you know, we're coming in with this part of it when we want to go in and say, look, we are the communications experts, we want to lead that top level, then integrate it into all the other levels. Advertising is just one of the areas. But, you know, we're in this constant battle, I find, especially with advertising, where, you know, they rule the roost with the marketing department.
I wonder actually with the future of PR though, whether it actually lies in having access to production anyway, regardless of
I'm digital. I mean, content is where we come from now. I mean, you know, I mean, we shoot video, we edit it, but we still don't have the, you know, 200,000, 3 million budgets to do the shoots anywhere we want. You know, that's the big difference. Ultimately, that's the battle that comes into it, that we don't have a budget to do this. We might have an amazing idea, but, you know, there's no way in hell a marketer's going to go, well, you're not our advertising department. We're going to give you this big $2 million budget.
Is it possible for a, this might be the wrong word, but poorly presented entry that's got a really brilliant idea that it's presenting to win, do you think, Terry?
I think a brilliant idea that is poorly presented could win, but it won't beat a brilliant idea that is well presented. And I think that is an issue that the agencies understand how to enter, especially the videos. They understand it. But, you know, we are living in an integrated world. We're living in a converging world. We're living in a world where holding companies own PR agencies, they own agencies, they own media agencies, and we're living in a world where the client increasingly says, I just want to deal with one person, hence Titanium and Integrated is such an important thing. It's showing that you can do one thing. And one of the things we say is, sooner or later, why don't you guys actually get together and talk? And you know, you're an expert at this. How do we actually do that? We're part of the same group. Why don't we do that? You know, and it's a bit like, the digital department's there and the creative department's there. Well, hang on, guys. You know, everything's digital. So you've got the intellectual adopters and the intellectual thinkers on one hand who know what's happening in the world. And then you've got the doers on the other who actually make it happen. And one of the things we will introduce at Cannes this year, almost certainly, is a new award called the Holding Company of the Year Award, which will reward the holding company who has amassed most points using the criteria that we use for Network of the Year and so on and so forth. And that will reward... you're Omnicon, huh?
Yeah, I'm Omnicon.
So that will reward... you know, sort of Fleischmann, Hillard, BBDO, DDB, anything within Omnicron group or the WPP group or Interpublic or Publicis. Yeah. So you'll, for the first time, be able to say, this holding company won more at Cannes than any other holding company.
Yes.
And of course, they do it unofficially anyway.
But we'd love to be able to say we're officially the world's most creative holding company.
Yeah. So that will be new this year. And then hopefully that will make people sort of more focused to actually use the resource to...
I think a lot of the time it comes down to bean counters and the whole integration thing comes down to cost a lot of time as well.
Well, next we're going to catch up with Jonty. So, Jonathan Est, Communications Director of the Media Alliance and friend of the podcast. Now, Jonty, since you've last been in, your life has taken a few turns. Now, we don't generally sort of talk about personal stuff in the podcast, but you wrote very powerfully on Crikey's health blog, Crokey, about your experience of cancer this year.
Yeah.
What did the experience of being a journalist and writing about it, did that give you a sense of control over the process?
A little bit. I guess the reason I did the blog in the end was I was having dinner with a good friend, an ex-colleague, Steve Waterson, who edits the Weekend Australian mag. And we were talking and I was yarning. There are quite a few, you know, I found it helped to find the funny side of things that along the kind of cancer journey, if you like. And so I was having a bit of a yarn and having a bit of a laugh. And he said, you know, you really ought to write about this. And I sort of said, well, you know, why would I want to do that? And he said, well, there'll be people out there who don't have your level of support. Perhaps, you know, are sitting there sort of bricking themselves kind of thing. And maybe to read somebody writing honestly about how they feel about being diagnosed with cancer would be a great help. And I've got to say, I've had a lot of feedback in terms of comments on the blog from people who've said, look, I'm going into hospital next week to have my operation, you know, and just reading what you've written has made me feel better about it. So, you know, that's very rewarding. And I think personally it helped me get my head around things to sit in front of a screen and marshal my thoughts and write something.
I sometimes think as a journalist, I sit down to write an opinion piece and I don't actually know what I think until I've written it down.
Yeah, well, exactly. That's exactly how I felt. And also it's cathartic just actually being able to sort of, you know, take it out on a piece of paper rather than your mates or whatever. So yeah, it was good, and it gave me, you know, gave me something to think about while I was in hospital, and I found it a very rewarding part of the process, actually.
And you're fully back to work early next year?
Early next year, yeah. In fact, if you hear receding footsteps in about 20 minutes, it's because I'm going off to have my stitches taken out for the final operation, which I had a couple of weeks ago, which is why I wasn't at the Walkley Awards this year. And then, frankly, all the pathology that came back has said I'm clear. So, you know, I think I can, you know, rule a line under the whole experience, and kind of 2011 is onwards and upwards.
And
so
you missed the, it must be the first Walkley's you've missed for quite some time.
Actually, to be fair, it's not. I wasn't at last year's Walkley's either.
Some communications director, are you?
I was at a wedding in India with some old friends. And it's always a bit weird because you do so much work on this thing. And in fact, there were two reasons for me to be in Melbourne this year, because we also launched a major report, which I'd taken quite a lot, you know, spent a lot of time writing. And then I went into hospital, literally the day we signed off to print, I went into hospital the next day. So I'd have loved to have been there kind of waving a copy of the report around, but you know, they
touch on the report in a minute. Yeah. First, so the Walkleys themselves, which were the standout awards? You've already mentioned Laurie Oakes.
Yeah, well, Laurie for me was, you know, it was well-deserved. He made a fantastic speech, and we're going to talk about
WikiLeaks a bit later, yes.
Look, there are various awards stand out. Paul McGough, you know, I thought.
So he's Sydney Morning Herald. He was the guy who was on board the flotilla.
Yeah, yeah, he was, and I followed what he was writing. He was blogging. He was you know, using all manner of media in order to keep his audience sort of updated on what was going on, and also writing in the way that Paul, you know, can, you know, very vivid. You felt you were there.
Well, it was powerful writing, wasn't it? Because he was actually temporarily held by the Israelis,
right,
when,
yeah,
the flotilla was captured. And I remember reading the very powerful phrase on the day it came out, something along the lines of they hunted like jackals.
That's right, yeah, yeah.
Which really created...
You felt you were there.
But it also created a kind of backlash as well. People were saying, well, this is, you know, this is biased writing, was the accusation. But it won the Walkley, which I guess is vindication.
Yeah, look, I think it was, and it was a popular winner. I think, he set out to write a vivid, you know, description of what he saw. I mean, part of the thing is actually being there, being on the spot. And, you know, he and let's not forget Kate Geraghty as well,
the photographer.
They were working together, and some of her work was fantastic.
Yes, and she did amazing things to hide the memory cards and stuff,
right,
sort of about,
yeah,
her person and stuff, you know, to get them out.
Let's not forget considerable sort of personal risk as well, that to get this, and this was, you know, one of the big stories of the year.
Well, the thing is, it's probably badass journalism.
That's right.
You know, people sort of moan about Fairfax and their money problems and stuff, but you forget there are lots of individual journalists who still do proper amazing work.
Well, Paul McGough is, you know, is one of these people, and he's you know, he seems to have this knack of being. I remember he was on an APC carrier in Iraq when it was shelled, you know, and he was there, and obviously that, I think there was some. I'm sure there were some journalists killed, but he was on the spot. Paul McGough has that happy knack as a journalist of being on the spot for big stories.
He's written a really good book called In Baghdad as,
yeah,
well, which, if you're a journalist, is a really good read, because it sort of, it alternates his reports with actually what it was like being the journalist, being there, you know, and sort of just the practicalities again, you know, filing stories when you can't get
That's
a lock,
right,
on the satellite for your satellite phone and things like that.
Yeah, well, I remember at the time I was working on the Oz backbench, and one of my jobs was to liaise with our people in the field, and just the incredible hoops they had to jump through to file their reports and to try and get photographs across this sort of ether in time to get in edition, and that kind of stuff was, you know, just that they had to go through the most amazing, jump through hoops, basically, was a better way of putting it than that.
Well, we should talk briefly about Life in the Clickstream, which is the report that has just gone to press. Now, this is kind of the second update of the future of the wider future of journalism report.
Yeah, look, I think the first report we did, which is 2 years ago, was really a bit of a kind of sounding a bit of an alarm for the news media to say, look, you know, we face a lot of challenges, and at that stage, I think the Australian news media certainly gave me the impression that it had its fingers in its ears and its eyes firmly closed and was going la la la, you know, it's all fine, and our report basically was all about saying, look, it's not all fine, you know, we have got these problems and we have to sort things out. 2 years down the track, you know, and I'd like to think it's as a result of all the work we've been doing. But 2 years down the track, obviously, you know, a lot has happened. There are organisations, and we saw this with Fairfax just recently, you know, they're really working out or continuing to work out how they're going to meet the challenges. The report that we've just released is a more in-depth study of what journalists in the newsrooms are experiencing, how their jobs are changing. But also we commissioned a study of the public in Australia to ask them what do you want from journalism.
You have a copy here.
How do you consume news? Who do you trust to tell you news? What do you think of, you know, issues like quality, trust, that kind of stuff? We're very pleased with it. I think it's a you know, required reading.
And if I could, let me recommend page 51 in particular, where you very kindly mentioned the umbrella business model as one alternative model.
Well, we wanted to look.
That's my favourite page. 51.
Page 51, folks. What we wanted to do, what this report aims to do, is to try and move the debate beyond, you know, Christ, we're in trouble kind of thing, into how, what can we as an industry do and start to do to kind of to meet the challenges.
Well, it's a really positive tone, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it is.
It comes across as, okay, this is actually, there's a big opportunity here as well.
Well, I think so. You know, we've sort of broken down the last chapter is very much about what are we going to do, and we've sort of asked what should the industry be doing, and in a word, that is innovate. You know, you've got to try stuff. I think it's easy to say we really need to be experimenting, but I don't think we're experimenting enough. And I think what we've tried to do in that we've got a chapter on innovation. We've tried to sort of, as far as we possibly can. Of course, these things move incredibly fast, but we've tried to sort of give a cross section of things that are going on around the world that people are doing things extremely well. You know, things we should be trying over here. We're also asking, and this is, you know, it's a bit of a dirty word sometimes with commercial news agencies. But how can government help the news industry in Australia? Because if you take it as a given that journalism is a public good which needs to be maintained, then really government can play a role in helping maintain that. Now in fact I think James Murdoch said in his MacTaggart lecture a year ago in Britain, the only true guarantor of independence is profit. And poo-pooed this idea that government should have any real involvement in news at all. And you can see how, you know, commercial news organisations would feel like that. But we've actually covered in quite a sort of in-depth way just how many countries are talking to their governments about, you know, in America,
I think
Britain especially.
The answer is going to end up being there are several different models as well. I guess there won't be any one model. By the way, if people want to see the reports,
you can go to www.futureofjournalism.org.au or go through the Walkley's website, which is www.walkleys.com.au.
Well, next, the Oprah effect.
If you don't win, I don't win. And I think this has been a win-win for every single partner involved. I know that there's a lot of talk and concern in this country about what this will mean for Tourism Australia, and there will be councils measuring how many people came and did the rates go up and all of that. Let me just tell you, this is the truth. It is immeasurable what 4 hours of a love festival about your country, broadcast in 145 countries around the world, can do.
So that clip you just heard was Oprah Winfrey speaking about the return on investment Australia will see from the visit of the Oprah show and Oprah's ultimate Australian experience. Starting to feel like possibly the biggest PR stunt of all time for Brand Australia. Now, Terry, you can probably offer quite a good perspective on this, as in you're something of a global traveller. What do you see as the potential value to Australia of the visit?
Well, just huge coverage, endorsement by someone that I think is sort of respected universally. And for the investment, I suspect there's been a lot worse investments in terms of both advertising and non-advertising made by Australia than her visit.
Scott, PR value?
Oh, look, I think it's probably the biggest PR coup ever. I mean, it's just priceless. How was it, 145 countries that Oprah shows in? You can't beat that thing. And, I beat my PR drum quite a lot these days. And I told, as I said last week, it was flash from hell in the US that actually worked with Tourism Australia and Oprah to help them come up with this campaign. And I think it's just genius. I mean, for the coverage you're going to get, when it goes live in the US, there'll be snippets of it on the web, and then when it goes translated into other countries, it's just going to be huge. I think one of the greatest things about it is the fact that it's been done without any advertising. And I think there'll be advertising wrapped around it, I have no doubt, when it airs. But I think it does go to show you that what can be done.
John T.
Well, look, I mean, everywhere you go the last couple of days, people want to talk about Oprah. You know, I was in a cab, and literally that was the only topic of conversation. You think if the buzz that's created in Australia is replicated in the US, and let's not forget everywhere else in the world, as Scott was noting, you know, it's a story, and it's a great story, and you know, people are going to be very. It's fantastic exposure.
You're listening to the Umbrella Cast. I'm Tim Burrows. With me today, Jonathan Est of the Media Alliance, Terry Savage of the Cannes Lions, and Fleischmann Hillard's Scott Rowdy. So Fairfax Media announced this week the end of Sport and Style magazine, which was something of a shame. As a sort of little aside, it's not that long ago since they launched their iPad app, so I suspect it's probably been the first iPad app that has launched and then closed, which I'm not sure you can count that as innovation or not. Scott, I'm guessing you were an occasional reader of Sport and Style?
Yeah, I was, but I just found it didn't hit me as a market, I have to be honest. I felt like I was reading GQ, I guess, in a way. It felt like it was aimed at a bunch of metrosexual sports blokes who don't really do sport, they just want to look posy. And, you know, that's not me. I play football and I wear football gear. That's what I do when I wear, you know, and I think I just felt as though it just didn't connect with most people, because if you're going to aim at that target niche, there's not that many of them out there.
Jonty, do you think there is still a place for men's mags?
Certainly, yeah. Look, when I heard that we were going to be talking about this, I went and did my homework and had a look at the, I didn't look at the app, I looked at the launch film for the app, and the thing that it reminded me very much of was the about a year ago when Sports Illustrated released their iPad demo, which is, I think, the thing that got everybody around the world going, God, iPads, you know, they're going to be fantastic. And it really looked like that. But I can remember talking to a senior exec from one of the media companies who, and I was raving about this, and he said, well, yeah, but think how much it costs to do this. And so I don't know any of the details, whether how much it cost Fairfax to put out Sport and Style as an iPad app. I'm saddened that we've now had the first closure, 6 months after it launched? But I think that this is a warning signal that the iPad, you know, may not be the panacea that everybody is hanging their hats on. You know, that these things are very expensive to do properly. And you've got to ask yourself how much money they're generating right now.
I think you have to aim at the market as well. I think, yeah. You know, if you create it, you throw out a niche, and it's a niche of a niche, and this product's currently a niche product, you know, you're throwing it out to a niche of a niche, and that's tough.
I tell you, I can think of one niche that would pay, though, and that would be the Lions iPad app. That must be in the pipeline somewhere, surely.
Yeah, I think you may see one this year, yes.
Yeah, no, I mean, you could just think of the potential with the speakers, the results, everything else. Yeah, you think you'll have it ready in time for this?
I think it will be ready, yes.
It'll be a big download if it contains all the videos, or if it's just links, it'll be okay.
Well, next we ask the question, is advertising really no fun anymore? So this week, advertising agency Droga5 took out a full-page ad. One of the complaints of the manifesto, I suppose, was the industry is a less fun place than it used to be, and hey, let's make our New Year's resolution for next year, let's make the industry fun again. Scott?
I don't know, they're working in advertising. I've worked in journalism, I've worked in public relations, I work in digital. The one area I suppose I've never worked in is advertising. I don't know, I just came across as a... What are we rating this one, this podcast at?
Yeah, no, I'd rather we don't have to use the explicit warning.
Okay, in that case, I'd put it as an egotistical swear word fest. Is probably the best way to describe it.
We're talking about the agency now. Isn't that just from that pure point job style?
Well, you've just asked me the question. That's why we're talking about it. But
surely that shows it's working.
To be honest, otherwise I wouldn't have seen it because it was in a newspaper.
John T, you used to, obviously in your days on the media section, the Australian, you used to write about the advertising industry from time to time. What were your impressions of it? Do you get the impression that it's more fun to be in than journalism, for instance?
No. I must say, I never did. And we talked about this before we came in here, but I don't know how newsrooms have changed over 2 or 3 years, because I haven't been in, and you know, I haven't been working in newsrooms. For journalists, certainly advertising is the, you know, that Chinese wall has always existed, and you always thought of advertisers as being people from a very strange land, who are basically got in the way of your journalism. And you were forever really just cursing them under your breath and saying, for Christ's sake, let's have those pages now. So we never felt, I mean, journalists, rightly or wrongly, have always thought of journalism as being the most fun you can have with your clothes on. Although you'd have to ask journalists, I think, now whether they feel the same way. I love the idea of sort of sitting in an easy chair, coming up with, you know, brainstorming ideas with a damp cloth around your head kind of thing. Is that a picture that you...
I'm trying to think of a similar analogy for a journalist.
Look, I think we're two sides of a sort of similarly creative industry, and one thing I do hope is that those two sides are learning to work together much better.
I think it's convergence is happening.
Better.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Yeah, but I suppose, Terry, and you've always been around the advertising world. Do you have sympathy with that view that maybe it isn't quite as much fun as it used to be?
Why would it be fun? We've just come through a GFC. The reality is that from a global perspective, whether you're a holding company or an independent, you have more and more financial pressure on you. The clients are more demanding. You're time poor. Anyone in this business is time poor. So, you know, there's a reality that's the world we live in. The rapidity of change is massive. Communications processes are now must be immediate. So I think there's a whole lot of factors that, in fact, have taken the fun element out of probably life, not just advertising. Yeah, I think it's not just necessarily advertising.
I think that's why I felt it was a bit of a ego trip, because I felt that every industry's suffering. You know, everybody went through the GFC,
yeah,
and I felt like, you know, maybe it's all became not so fun for everybody.
But you know what? It was nicely written, and there's an awful lot of people that have spoken to me about it.
So, actually,
so it has achieved something.
It was on YouTube. I have to admit, I picked up on it a little bit, and some of the writing on it wasn't so great. It was written creatively, but not.
Next, we talk WikiLeaks. Now, John T, I know we've got to get you out the door in a minute, so I'll do WikiLeaks very, very quickly. So major Australian editors from TV, from a few from radio, certainly loads from press, this week signed a letter expressing their support for WikiLeaks. This was organised by the
Walkley Foundation,
Urging governments not to prosecute the Australian Julian Assange, who obviously heads up WikiLeaks. What was the thinking behind the letter?
Well, I think, and we touched on sort of PR and crisis management, and in a sense, this is an example of you know, a campaign that we've been running and is working very, very well. I mean, it's a crucially important thing for journalism that we recognise that the WikiLeaks is, you know, it changes the way journalists can work. It provides such a service. I mean, the stories coming out of these WikiLeaks the cables are just amazing. They are sort of changing the way we think about the world. Journalism has always depended on leaks. As Laurie Oakes said in his speech for when he was given the gold Walkley, we depend on leaks. Whether that's just a file put through your letterbox at 2 a.m, or whether it's a dump of 250,000 diplomatic cables, these are things that people have got a right to know about. The knee-jerk reaction, which just blew my mind, really. You know, this idea that he must be doing something illegal, and I thought it was quite depressing. And still, in the US, there's quite a lot of media organisations that are saying that, and sort of having him on for being, or having WikiLeaks on for being irresponsible.
Was it Palin called him un-American and treasonous? Yes. No, he's not American.
that's a minor detail.
To some, un-American might be a compliment. One question I did have, actually, I noticed. I don't think the West was a signatory to the letter. Was that? Was that just not having time to get them on it?
Look, I'm not sure. At this point, I have to say this was all happened while I was still in hospital. So while I've read the letter, I've had a look at the list of editors. It's a very, very impressive list of people that have signed the document. Mm. I hadn't noticed whether the West had or not.
That's unfortunately where we have to leave it because we're very much out of time. It's probably appropriately for the last one of these podcasts of the year. It's probably the longest podcast as well. Over Christmas and New Year, the Mumbrella cast will be offering you catch-ups from the last couple of Mumbrella question times. For now, though, thanks very much to my co-host, Scott Rohde.
Thanks, Tim.
And to our guest today, Jonathan Est of the Media Alliance. And to Terry Savage of the Cannes Festival of Creativity.
Thank you.
Thanks also to CBS Interactive for use of their studios throughout 2010. Production was by Georgina Pearson. That was the Mumbrella cast. I'm Tim Burrows. Toodle.